Hey, it's Wendy. I'm back with a new podcast episode today. And in fact, I'm here with a whole entire podcast series. And this series is going to be one where I interview all of the new instructors that are going to be instructors in Fodder School 3. And I'm really excited to bring this to you because everyone has a story and I can't wait to tell all of their stories. So without further ado, I bring you today's podcast episode. Welcome to Show Up or Shut Up, a podcast about prolific makers, specifically in the world of mixed media art. I'm your host, Wendy Solganic, also known as Willa Wanders, and I'm here to explore the ups and sometimes the downs of being a prolific mixed media artist. I've been a maker my entire life, and I've had four, yes, four separate careers involving art. In each episode, we'll talk to artists about how they became prolific makers, why they make art, and the struggles they go through. We'll talk about being an online creative, social media, and how to navigate that world if that's what you're into. Whether you're a casual art lover of mixed media art and collage, or a serious artist making a living with art, whether you're a handmade book artist, an art journaler, a 3D assemblage creator, a fiber artist, a collage artist, or everything all at once, I hope you'll join me on this journey into the world of mixed media making. If you like this podcast, hit the subscribe button and leave a review. You can find me, Wendy, at willowanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders and at fodder.school. A word of caution about this episode. So if you've been following this podcast for a while, you know that I'm talking a lot every episode about the audio issues that I've been having. And this episode is like the worst. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to Jennifer that this episode has so many audio issues. The good news is that the audio issues are not on Jennifer's end. They're on my end. And the other good news is that throughout my recording of this series, I completely changed the way that I record podcast episodes, and everything should be totally fine and totally fixed for the future at some point in this series. So I can't remember if I fixed it right after recording with Jennifer or if I fixed it maybe an episode or two later. But just so you know, my podcasts of the future are not going to have these audio issues. And I'm so sorry that this one did. But that's kind of just an unfortunate part of doing what I do with the technological abilities that I have. But again, got it fixed. Super happy. Happy to be moving forward. Welcome to the podcast, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this cloudy day. Is it cloudy by you?
It is sporadically sunny, but it's mainly cloudy, yeah. And chilly.
And chilly. Tell us where you live.
I am in Washington, D.C., in the Georgetown neighborhood. So we're just minutes from the Potomac River. And it's a pedestrian neighborhood, which I love.
It's so fancy.
It's kind of fancy. Our house isn't fancy, but it's a great neighborhood to live in.
Tell us about the home you live in. Isn't it like buildings there?
Yep, most of them are pretty old. And our house is, I guess, from the 1890s. But what's funny is what I love and where I'm talking to you from is my studio, which is up in what we call the carriage house. It never actually had a carriage. There was never a door big enough to let a carriage in, but it was a little extra building on the property. And I was trying to figure out how old it was. So I went to the local library and looked at historic maps with the librarian. And he said, well, when your house was built, that little building was there. You know, let's look at the previous map. Let's go further back. And so we actually went 100 years back and we found that the carriage house, or whatever it was, is 100 years older than the house and used to belong to Alexander Graham Bell.
Oh my lordy, I love that.
The house three houses down. So property lines have changed and new houses have been built between the houses. But we think it used to be maybe a kitchen.
So you call it a carriage house, but it was actually not a carriage house.
No, it's just like, I guess you would call it an auxiliary dwelling or auxiliary building, but it looks like a carriage house. It's just, you can tell from the topography that there's no way a carriage ever could have entered.
And maybe it was a kitchen to a larger house.
Yeah, it seems like it must have been one of the, so probably several little buildings that were for different things on a much larger property with a much larger main house down the street.
And what year was this building that your studio was in? What year was it built?
It's about 1795.
Oh my gosh. Does it have all the character of, you know, that what? Original when, thing?
We bought our house as is. It was in really bad shape, and the carriage house was in especially bad shape. So the architect had a structural engineer come and look at it to check the mortar, because it looked like it might have been okay, but some bits were crumbling. And when I asked him how it was, he said, "You know, it looks pretty good, unless we get a strong wind." In which case, it might all come down. So it turns out every piece of wood, every timber in the building was completely rotted. So it doesn't have the character from the inside. It all feels new, but gotcha. That's okay. It looks great from the outside.
Oh my gosh. I would love to see it. Do you ever post pictures of it on Instagram?
I do. I should have posted. I posted it on my non-art account the other day, but I'll post a picture of it. It's a little building, but I just love that I have a quiet space for making art that is separate from the main house, the mailbox, the kitchen, the list of things to do. I feel like when I'm out here, time just sort of stands still.
Approximately how big is it? Like feet by feet?
Oh, well, let's just say it has room for a large, cheap IKEA dining table and room to walk around it.
Okay, so it's a little building.
Yeah, it's a little building. Downstairs, we have like a love seat with a big TV and a bookshelf and an exercise machine. So,
oh, it's two floors, the building
it's
itself?
It's two floors in my studio's upstairs.
With
kind of like a low slanting ceiling, but with a skylight. So it usually has nice light for working. And right now I'm just having kids classes here in the afternoons. Neighborhood kids have been coming here for years. And one time when they came through, they said, "You know, Mrs. Panic, what's the downstairs?" And I said, "Well, it's kind of a lot of things. It's the exercise room, it's the TV room, it's the library. And then it's a sofa bed. So if we have extra guests, they could actually sleep here." And one of the kids said, "I have an idea. Why don't we come for art class? And then we watch a movie and have a sleepover."
Aww.
It was so cute. I thought it was so adorable that they might actually think I would be good company on an 8-year-old sleepover. They're just adorable.
Okay, we have quite a bit to talk about. Before we get into all the questions that I now have for you, the first thing I want to ask you is, how do people find you right now as they're listening, so that when we have this conversation, they have a reference point of, oh, I know Jennifer's work. Okay, now I see what they're talking about. So on Instagram, what is your main art account?
My main art account is my full name, which is also the address of my website. It's just Jennifer Wilkin Penick.
And how do you spell Wilkin Penick?
Wilkin is W-I-L-K-I-N. And Penick is P-E-N-I-C-K. So all together, Jennifer Wilkin Penick will get you both Instagram and my website.
Okay. But your name right now, like people call you Jennifer Penick. They don't call you for Wilkin Penick.
I would say my family just, yeah, they think of me as having a first name and a last name, but I moved my maiden name to be my middle name when I got married. So it is my legal middle name.
Got you. Well, I think I've told you, I love the way that it sounds. I don't know why, but I just think Jennifer Wilkin Penick It's like,
it's a mouthful.
I can't explain it. I love it.
I kept thinking about abbreviating it. And then I thought, probably the easiest way for people to find me is for there to be no one else who has that Instagram account. Or maybe I should have done like Jennifer Pinnock Art, but I didn't think about it.
Gotcha. Well, I really like Jennifer Wilkin Pinnock, so I'm happy that you did
it's,
that.
It's working for me because people do find me, which is wonderful. And I just think that once you commit it to memory, you can remember it. It's long enough that it kind of sticks with you.
Yes, it sticks with you. That's exactly what it is. Okay, so Jennifer Wilkin Pinnock, let's go back to the beginning. Where are you originally from?
I'm a West Coaster all the way. I was born in Napa, California. I was raised in the Bay Area until high school, when my mom thought we should move to Oregon because it was safer, which I think was another way of saying more boring. So we moved to Oregon when I was in high school. I mean, I love going there now, but when I was a kid, it seemed like the town my mom lives in had no movie theater. It was a real step back. And I kind of jumped around. I was really undecided what to major in as an undergrad. In fact, I started out as an English major, and then I thought, no, I should be an art major. So I went to University of Oregon. I took a bunch of classes at Portland State University, where there was an artist I wanted to study with. And after, I'm pretty sure, satisfying all of the requirements for an art major, like a double major, I somehow thought, this is totally impractical. I'm never going to be an artist. I should go back and get a really practical degree and finish up my degree in English literature, which is what I did.
Really practical.
Yeah. I think because my grandfather, who was an editor of a Bay Area paper, he always said, I never hire people with degrees in journalism. I always hire English majors because at least they can write. I always thought, well, if my grandfather always wanted to hire English majors, that's clearly a very practical thing to be. So I did finish up my...
Do you love writing?
I do. I'm not a creative writer, but I'm a very competent writer. It's come in really handy in grad school, helping people write grants for refugee centers. And I loved getting a degree in English literature. And then I got my graduate degree in art history because writing has never been a problem. You know, I always have opinions. I realize all you have to do is have an opinion about something and then be able to write.
You have a graduate degree in art history?
I do. So I finished up my very last year at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington. And I did study abroad with them. Loved it. Went to Italy and told my mom, I'm clearly going to live in Italy when I grow up. And she's like, sure. Glad you like study abroad. That seems very impractical. But I did manage to go back to Italy. And on and off over the years, I sort of kept rising up in the University of Washington administration. So I started out as a student assistant running their center in Rome, Italy. And by the time I left, I was director. But at a certain point, there's like, it's kind of weird that you don't have an advanced degree and you're this high in the university administration. So I did go back and get an MA in art history.
So in order to get the MA in art history, did you have to learn multiple foreign languages?
Well, at the time, you could take the graduate school foreign language test, and I'd already lived in Italy for a while by then, so I aced it in Italian, and I took the French one right afterward, and I'd studied a little bit of French. I think the questions were the same, so I'm pretty sure I squeaked by, but I managed to pass it both in French and Italian. But I am fluent in Italian, which is great.
The one reason I didn't change my whole entire life trajectory and go and get a PhD in art history is because I absolutely stink at learning foreign languages.
Oh.
And I was in law school at UCLA and I was miserable. And I was like, I want to study art history. And I looked up what I would need to do to apply and what I would need to do to earn a degree. And it was like, you had to be two foreign languages that were on a list. And I was like, that will never happen for me.
Oh, you know, if I got my PhD, I would have to have learned German. But you didn't actually have to be fluent. At least at the University of Washington, they have a class that's called German for Readers. And so I could have worked on reading proficiency. I took like one quarter of German, but I thought it seemed very unlikely that I would ever have the time or the language ability to go for a PhD. But I really enjoyed getting my MA though. I mean, I love art. I'd always loved art, and it just seemed natural to take some time to do graduate work in it.
Well, wow. Okay.
So, but it was also easy to do, because when you live in Italy, you're just immersed in the art.
I have questions about Napa. So what was your family doing in Napa?
You know what? I think Napa wasn't like Napa with a capital N at the time. I think it was just Napa. I think my mom was working at the phone company. And I need to ask her, why was she working at the phone company in Napa? Because her parents, and she had previously lived in Vallejo, which is, you know, a little ways away. But I don't know exactly why she was in Napa, but I know that's where she had a job.
So it is quite beautiful there.
It is. It is. And I think I only lived there for just long enough to be born there. Maybe I think when I was two, she moved back closer to the Bay Area, back to where her family lived.
Okay. So you didn't go to grade school or junior high in the Napa Valley?
No. I went to both grade school and junior high in San Jose.
Oh, my God.
Again, I lived there before it was San Jose, like before it was Silicon Valley. It was very different back then.
Gotcha. Okay, all right. So you were born, then you said you moved to Oregon where your mom was from?
No, my mom is from California as well. We moved to Oregon when my first year of high school, because she thought it would be safer. She felt like there were our neighborhood was getting rough.
San Jose.
Yeah.
From San Jose. Okay. And then after your initial college, where did you go from there?
Well, I did study abroad in 1984 when I was 21. And the next year I went back as a teaching assistant on the same program that I'd been a student in the previous year. And I never came home. I lived there for 25 years.
Oh, gotcha. And this was in Italy.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
And I never was gone.
So tell us that story. What was that like? Where did you live? This is epic. Okay.
Oh, Rome was such a great place. I learned to drive in Rome. I don't know why I never got my driver's license before. I learned to drive in Rome, which is a crazy place because at the time they've changed the rules now, but I just got my boyfriend, who later became my husband, just bought me a scooter, because in Italy at the time, all you had to be was 14 to own a scooter. You didn't have to have a driving test. You didn't have to take any kind of exam. All you had to do was be 14 and alive, and you could just be handed a motor scooter. So that's how I learned to drive. Just
was it a Vespa?
Trial by fire. And my first one wasn't a Vespa, but I had many Vespas after that. And then I got into them, and I got like a Vespa with a manual transmission, and I could like wow Italian men as I would change my own spark plugs. I actually had one guy stop and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I have to change my spark plug." And he said, "An American changing the spark plug on a Vespa? This I've got to see." And he was carrying a heavy box, and he stood there with his heavy box the whole time. And he said, "I have to tell my wife about this when I get home." Anyway, it was very funny. Sort of growing up and living in a country where I was so clearly a foreigner because I look very foreign. And yet because I lived with an Italian, I was married to an Italian for 17 years who spoke no English, my Italian got really good. And so people would just sound sort of confused when they would hear me talk. But yeah, it was a great place to live. And it was great to work for an American university, because it gave me an opportunity to speak English. It sort of allowed me to have some lifeline to American culture and not be completely out of it. Although to this day, if people mention like certain TV shows or ad campaigns or food fads, it's like, sorry, I missed that whole thing.
You missed 25 years of American life. Well, it sounds like a fantasy. It honestly does. First of all, for people who haven't been to Italy before, like the food there is 10,000 million billion times better than the food in America. So you ate a town, like real, you ate in for 25 years of your adult life.
Yeah. I kind of learned to cook. I think my signature dish before I went to Italy was like basmati rice with Swiss cheese and chicken. So I learned to cook there. I had a really bossy boss, and she was a really good cook. And she would have these things called didactic dinners, where she'd teach her architecture students how to cook and how to have a dinner party and all that. And I would just gladly go along and learn as much as I could from her.
Wow. Didactic dinner parties. What's the definition of didactic?
Well, I think that you learn from it. So she had students who, she was an architect and taught for the University of Washington's architecture program. And she believed that if you're going to be designing a space in which people live, you first of all need to know how to live. And if you're a 21-year-old college student, you probably don't fully know how to live enough to design a space. Wow. So she would make them sort of go through all the moves of, you know, planning a party, how many people, where are they going to sit? You know, how are they going to cook? Are you going to have enough room? And so she thought that it sort of informed their work in architecture, but it also, you know, brought them more into her world, which was very much that of a European bon vivant. And she was a big influence on me. She was the first woman to get both the Rome Prize in Architecture and a Fulbright or something. You know, she was quite a bit older than me, but she, I don't know, I feel like she must have sort of bullied the people in the upper administration, because there are not many state universities in Italy, at least in Rome, that have, you know, amazing centers for their study abroad. Usually they have, you know, a few rooms or a space they rent. But anyway, I learned to cook and a lot from her, and then being married to an Italian, you learn to really cook your pasta right. Because I still remember the first time I ever cooked pasta for him. He said, "Oh, thank you so much. It's very nice, but I can't eat it." I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "Oh, it's just so soft." I realized, oh, al dente. That's right. Really seriously. I mean, he could have been a little bit nicer. He was a little fussy. But yeah, I learned to cook, and I actually love to cook now and love to throw dinner parties. So those didactic dinners worked on me too.
So when did you go back to making art? Because it sounds like you were working in university administration while you were in Rome.
I was, but you know, I never stopped making art. I mean, I'd spent, you know, in high school, I got like art student of the year and history student of the year, which I didn't remember. I thought I'd got English student of the year. And then I ran across my high school records recently and I was like, history student? I had no idea. But I did get art student of the year. I loved sketching. I loved keeping a sketchbook. And so when I did my graduate work in art history, I always had these sort of beautiful hand-bound sketchbooks that they make near the Pantheon in Rome. And I would just sketch all my notes and I would illustrate them from whatever slides are being shown. So I really got in the habit of just drawing and going out in Rome and, you know, sketching. And I did that always. And at some point, I guess maybe, I don't know, maybe 20 some years ago, I started having girlfriends come over and we would make collages. I think I morphed into collage work because I would always go to the Rome flea market and I was so fascinated by all of these cool old pieces of paper you could buy for a song. It used to be, it was like 50 cents or less per page, weird old letters and documents and photos. So I did start working in collage at least 20 years ago. But I always, before that, I never stopped, you know, sketching and watercoloring. So I never felt like I really let go of making art.
Do you still do the watercoloring and the sketching?
I haven't for a few years, but I used to teach a course here, in an in-person course before COVID, sketching in DC. So I think it was called Sketchbook DC. So we would actually go out and sketch at a different site around DC every week.
Like an urban sketching group?
Yeah. I did it through the Museum of Contemporary Art Arlington. They offered the course and I would meet people. It was enjoyable.
So take me through the part of your story where you return to the United States.
It's a love story. So one of the best. So I did divorce the Italian who made my Italian language skills so strong. And we sort of remained friends. And then he, unfortunately, a few years ago died of cancer. But I was single and it's sort of funny. I guess as somebody in her 40s, I just thought, oh, I'm sure I'll meet some great guy. Well, I didn't. And I was sort of happy. I had a great apartment. I had a great network of friends. But I did meet this great guy who had been given my number as someone who might be able to help him translate because his daughter had been hospitalized. She was traveling with her friends after high school. And she had got some sort of, I guess it turned out to be a viral fever. Whatever it was, she actually was hospitalized. He didn't need my help. She got better quite quickly and moved on with her friends to Florence. And he thought, well, I'm stuck in Rome for 4 days, so I will call that person whose name I got. And we had lunch, and he seemed very nice. I sort of thought, I don't know, he seems very nice, but I'm sure I'll never see him again. But he actually came back the next year. And it's sort of a long story. I don't know if we want to deal with that now. But through a series of coincidences and our annual fundraiser, he ended up coming back again with his aunt and uncle, who bid on the grand prize at our fundraiser, which was staying in the director's apartment for a week, which has a panoramic terrace overlooking all of Rome. And, you know, his aunt, two aunts and one uncle are elderly, and they said, is there room for one more person in the apartment? Our nephew broke up with his girlfriend. And it turns out that was the guy I'd had lunch with the year before. So he came back again. And because they were very much VIP guests, you know, they were the highest bidders on this auction item. I, you know, arranged a visit to an art exhibit. I organized a little reception for them and some other people. I ended up sort of spending, I don't think, and then another dinner with this guy who I'd only had lunch with. And when it came time to say goodbye, he said, I'd like to see you again. I said, well, you live in DC and I live in Rome. I'm not sure how that would work. And he said, well, what are you doing this summer? Because that was, I think it was May maybe. And I said, I'm taking my nephew to Berlin. I've always loved taking my sister's kids traveling with me. So he said, well, maybe I could meet you and your nephew in Berlin. And I thought, sure. So he did. He came and met us. He was just a totally great guy. I sort of fell for him. My nephew, you know, thought he was the bee's knees. And we distance dated for a year and a half, meeting up someplace in the world every month. Wow. So it was super romantic. We met up in like London, Paris, Berlin, Venice, Rome, DC, Seattle. And after a year and a half, he asked if I would consider moving back to the US. And I said, I would, as a matter of fact. I've been at my job for 25 years at that point. It seemed a really good idea. So he lived in DC, and that's why I moved back here. And now it's been 12 years, and it feels like it's been three.
That is an awesome story.
It's funny because I was talking to a woman in an Italian food store here, and she said, you know, she speaks Italian. She's Italian. We were speaking in Italian. And she said, wait a minute. Let me get this. You went to Rome for work, and you came to Arlington for love? I think he got that backwards. Like, well, that's the way it went. But we do go back to Italy often, which is great. We call it one of the part of the unwritten marriage contract that we have to go back often.
Is that where you go every year for a month or something? Don't you have some place that you like to go for an extended stay?
Before, Rome was always like sort of my only most happy place, but my husband and his sisters inherited this little tiny island in Lake Huron in Ontario, Canada, from their parents. And it is so magical and so quiet, but it is the absolute opposite of Rome. There are no shops. There are no restaurants. You can just wear like holy jeans the whole time because no one's going to care. There are no cars. There are no sounds. There's no internet. There's no TV. But I love it. I love completely just immersing myself in kayaking and friends and, you know, meals on the deck for an entire month. We actually haven't gone for an entire month before, but now that my husband's retired and I'm taking a break, this year we will spend a whole month there.
So,
but it's like,
are there other people that live on the island?
No, it's just like one house on a little island, but there are lots of tiny, it's an area called 30,000 Islands. It's in Georgian Bay. And I think the 30,000 Islands are just the ones that are like over an acre. There are tons of them that are just like as big as a house. Ours actually has enough room for you to, like, I don't know, you could walk for like 3 minutes and get to the other side of the island.
How do you get from where you live now to a tiny isolated island in the middle of a great lake?
We drive to the nearest point, which is called Point O'Barrell in Ontario. And we leave the car and we pick up our boat. There's a marina there that keeps our boat over the winter because you can't even access this place in the winter at all. It just freezes over.
Wow.
We pick up our boat and then we are 7 miles out from mainland.
And then in order to go grocery shopping while you're there, you have to boat over to wherever the area is that has the supplies.
Yeah, what we try and do, we try and really stock up in advance, and then we can get enough cell phone service to send text messages to people. So we have usually have a bunch of friends and family who cycle through, and we, you know, go and text, you know, corn, milk, hot dog buns, or whatever.
Gotcha. And they cycle through, and you pick them up with the yep. boat and bring them out to the house.
Yeah.
That is a wild story.
It's really a great place, though. It's the water's super clear. And although everyone thinks that the further north you go, the water's going to be really cold, the water where we are is usually about 72 degrees. So
Lake Huron is a great lake, correct?
Yes. This
it's
is
an
in Georgia.
Island in a lake.
It is. It's one of many, many, many islands in a bay off of Lake Huron. So it's called Georgian Bay.
I'm gonna look
Bay.
At the map. This is wild. I live yeah. on a great lake.
Georgian Bay is the name of our little area. But there wow. is like there is a little grocery store just a couple islands over from us. I could actually kayak there if I had to, but it's easier to take a boat. And you can get like basics there, but you wouldn't want to, you know, do shopping for a crowd there.
When you're there, do you have cellular service?
You know, it's gotten better over the years. It used to be we had to actually like take a boat out into the bay to get and like wave your phone around to get cell service. And I feel like now usually you can get text messages and sometimes you can make phone calls.
Can you use a computer?
Our friends managed to get the New York Times crossword puzzle, but honestly, we don't even try. We don't even take our computers because
that sounds so lovely. Like,
yeah, I do have my phone and I
disconnect.
Can usually get enough bandwidth to like post a photo to Instagram at some point, but that's it. There's like, I don't even try and make phone calls unless, you know, there were an emergency. I would, you know, I think if you go upstairs, maybe there's some point where you can get better cell reception, but I like the fact that you can't.
Yeah. It sounds like time. A dream.
It's okay. Just, I am always tied to the computer now with Zoom classes and stuff. And it is so nice to get a total break from the screen.
So tell me about the job you're currently, how you got it, what you do, because it's a really interesting job.
So you mean my work as artist in residence?
Yes.
Yes. This has been such a surprise for me. I started out in 2018, I was actually contacted by someone in the Arts and Humanities program at Georgetown University because they had heard about me from my husband, who's always donated to the Cancer Center at Georgetown because although his wife died of cancer when she was 50, he felt she was really well cared for. And so he wanted to find a way to give back. And he met with somebody from development who said, well, how's your life going now? And he said, it's going really well. I've remarried. What does your wife do? She's an art teacher. And they said, oh, well, we know how you can give back. Why don't you have your wife talk to the Arts and Humanities Department? So I really hit it off with the director who, like me, is someone who did her graduate work in art history. And she said, we really need more visual artists to work, you know, with patients in the hospital. And I started out just working, I guess maybe I would go in 2 or 3 days a week and I would just hang out in the cancer center, what we call the art table. And I would either make art with patients or for patients. Sometimes I would go to patients' rooms and take them like Valentine cards that they could give to people, you know, handmade cards. I really enjoyed the contact with the patients, but then COVID happened and we weren't allowed in the hospital for years. And my boss said, if you guys want, there, I'm one of 15 artists in residence, by the way. There are, I think, three visual artists, movement artists, musicians, a writer, people who do knitting. There's sort of a whole range of artists who are paid to make the hospital environment more hospitable and less hospital. And she said, if you want to continue to get paid, you guys are going to have to think about how you can do something online. So maybe make some videos, do some, you know, art lessons. And at first I just said, oh my God, I couldn't possibly do that. I can't stand seeing my face on video. And she said, yeah, well, it's up to you. I mean, we can't pay you for nothing. So I tried it. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute, if I sort of tweak this, if I had, you know, all of my images with the steps I do, I sort of found a way for it to work. And I started offering regular classes on Mondays, and I call them Creativity Jumpstart. So the idea is that you bring whatever art materials you have to the table, and I give a creative prompt. We all work together and share what we did. And I said, I can't imagine doing this with more than 20 people. But the class would always sell out, and people, it doesn't cost anything for the people to take the class, but I am paid to teach it. So I raised the limit, and now I've raised the limit to 170 people, and I teach the same class twice a week. So there's this huge desire for people to take the class, but now it's been going on for years. So people know each other. There's this sort of wonderful sense of community that has been built up. And at the beginning, during sort of the height of the pandemic, it was so fundamental, I think, to so many people for dealing with anxiety and isolation and loneliness. But I sort of thought that people would be tired of it. They'd be like all zoomed out. And they said, oh, no, we're tired of going to Zoom meetings. We're not tired of doing art on Zoom. This is great because it allows people to join me from anywhere. So I had one woman who said, I'm going to have to leave class early. I'm just so tired. Keep in mind, in India, it's midnight. I just think it's so cool. I have people in my classes from around the corner and from India. You know, we're all sitting in our own spaces creating art together. So it has been a joy. And it has been popular, and it's got great feedback, and it has led to other things like this little exhibition that I am organizing.
Tell us about the exhibition. That's super fun. I've seen a little hint of it. I've heard you talk about it.
It is the snowball in my life. I somehow thought, oh, the collage community is a great one. So in honor of World Collage Day, which is May 13th, really soon, thank heavens. We'll have a call for art and see if people will send in 4x4-inch collages. The idea being that after we show them all on the walls of the Cancer Center on a few paper panels, we'll then attach them to blank greeting cards and allow patients to choose their favorite one from a basket that we always have near the check-in of the Cancer Center. And I somehow thought, people will send art and this is going to be great. And people would say, how many are we allowed to send? And I thought, allowed to send? I don't know, the more the merrier, right? I mean, how many could we possibly get? And my boss said recently, how many do you think we would get? And I said, I thought we would get between 200 and 300 submissions. We are now nearing 3,000 submissions. And I had no idea. I knew that the cancer patients would love getting handmade art. I mean, who wouldn't? It's so great. And it'll brighten everyone's day. What I didn't count on was how meaningful it would feel to the artists who are submitting their art.
Yeah.
So, and we have everything from preschool kids, special ed kids in Brazil, pensioners in Sweden. We have all these people gathering in groups, making art to go on cards for cancer patients in Washington, D.C., and thanking me for the opportunity to do something useful and practical with their art. That I had not envisioned. The absolute outpouring of generosity has been really moving and also overwhelming, because the Cancer Center doesn't have enough walls to display all the art that's been sent in. So we're now working on multiple venues, and I will be wording the call for art differently next year. And I'm also helping people who write think about how they can start something like this in their own community, because this, of course, is not particular to our cancer center. People in cancer centers and hospitals and senior centers the world over would love to receive handmade art. So I'm trying to encourage people to contact organizations in their own community so they can sort of keep the love going.
So I don't know if you knew this, but in Fodder School One, we did one of our months was making kindness cards. And
oh,
we
cool.
compiled a list of organizations that would take kindness cards, you know, that would receive kindness cards. A list of organizations in the Fodder School One curriculum so that people would have
so cool.
an app for their art, because I think what you are experiencing is a universal thing, which is art to make art, right? Like, a lot of people love making art, but what to do with our art is always...
Yeah, absolutely.
And myself, this is what totally drove my whole entire passion for the type of art that I create, is I just love making art, but I could not connect with that desire to a gallery artist or a craft fair artist. I knew that wasn't something that drove my passion, but I wanted to be able to have that artistic life where I could make as much art as I wanted to make. And the eternal question is what to do with all of that art. And when you can find something that has meaning as a cancer center or a school or a veterans group or just the many organizations that would be happy to have the art, it's like the perfect thing. And really essentially what Fodder School is it's an outgrowth of that desire in me to find ways to continue to create that feel good, because you feel like you're not just, you know, you're not confused, I guess, about why you keep creating. And that's why every month in Fodder School, there's a different big project.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, I can be challenged. I can have fun. I can share this. We can swap it. We can send it to a cancer center. We can make a book. We can make, you know, just finding something interesting and different so that you can keep doing what we all want to do, which is we all just want to create, because it is such a primal need.
Yeah,
I know.
You're so right. I mean, I've had people. I've had people flag wonderful organizations in my classes, and I don't know if people follow up, because I think this one, it's so active and immediate that they keep sending things. But we will move on to supporting other organizations. But also, someone said, "What do you do with all the art you create? You know, you're clearly so prolific. You're always making series of all these things," and I think, I basically turn everything into cards, and I take them to the cancer center at some point, unless I use them for cards for family, friends, you know, the desire to give them away and do something practical with them. I hear you. I have it. And it does. You just want to keep making your stuff, and I don't get attached to most of it. Sometimes, you know, I'll cut it up, I'll reuse it. You know, some things you save because you think this is, you know, this feels special. It's exactly what I wanted it to be. But then a lot of you think, I just wanted to work on that project. And now that I've done it, I've got all these little artworks, and it's just so fun for me to always know where they can find new homes.
So that it's just so important to feel like you have that permission to keep creating.
Exactly.
Because it's not for no reason. So, I mean, primarily, there was this quote that I heard maybe like 20 years ago from Thich Nhat Hanh. And it's probably my favorite quote of all time. He says, peace in oneself, peace in the world. And it's that Buddhist be of like, hey, you cannot outside of yourself. Like, that's the reality of life. We have very little control, but you can have peace in yourself. Then that is like something that you can do to contribute goodness into the world.
Yeah.
So if we're creating and we're sitting at our desk playing with color and paper and glue and mark making tools and scissors and all of that stuff, and we create those peaceful moments for ourselves, we are a more peaceful person as we go out and engage with the world. So for me, that is like number one. Like, there is a reason to do this, and you can tell by the number of people that want to participate in your free class and in fodder school and all the other millions and millions of mixed media art classes out there. Like, people want to create, they want that feeling of peace. It's so important.
And it's that go ahead.
No, you go.
No, I was just going to say, but I think that fodder school also gives that sort of dual, you need to create, but you also want to connect, and you want to know that other people are interested in doing what you're doing and get ideas from them. And so I think those two things together are so powerful.
Totally. Totally. You know,
the inspiring others, taking inspiration, feeling like you're sort of in your something. Artistic way, being adventurous and trying new things. It's exciting. And I think it fuels everyone's artistic nature to come in contact with, you know, new people and new techniques and new ideas.
Definitely. I know personally, like, I love trying something new, feeling like, okay, I've done that thing. I feel confident that I am capable of doing that thing, and then moving on and trying something else.
Yeah.
It's like a big part of my process is trying new things. And the only way I can keep fueling that desire is by taking classes from other artists, because I'm not some kind of like weird person who just ideas just continually download from the universe into. Like, the way that I get to try new things and fulfill that desire inside of myself is to just keep connecting with more and more artists and learning from them. And then that builds and builds and builds and builds. And I just keep having more and more and more fun.
I agree. I totally hear you. It is so true.
So how do you fulfill the need to try new things for yourself? It sounds like you have a very long history with art, but also, do you feel like you want to keep trying new things?
Oh, absolutely. I love, you know, when someone whose art I already admire on Instagram ends up offering a class, you know, in some online venue, and I can take it. I just think that's so cool. I can learn about collage from this artist, some interesting painting technique from another. And before COVID, I took more in person, but I must say recently, I think all of the classes I've taken since COVID have been online. But I love them. And sometimes I go for the free ones. You know, some artist I like mentions that he or she has put up a tutorial. I just love the accessibility of the information, having it online. And then I do have a lot of stuff in my studio. So usually I can kind of try anything without having to go buy supplies, which is a real luxury. But I,
right, because once you hit, there's like a certain point, I feel like, where you everything, like, pretty much for any class that you take.
Yeah. 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 I mean, there are like some like extreme limits. Like, I've taken encaustic classes, but I didn't actually invest in all of the materials and stuff. But other than that, you know, paints, watercolor, acrylic, and it's really fun. You know, people from different countries, people with very different styles. And one of the things that I've enjoyed from fodder school is that invitation to look at someone's work and their process. And even if it doesn't feel like it matches your style, to take something from it and turn it into your own style, which is what I'm always telling people in my classes. I try never to show only one artist's work that inspires me or to inspire us, because what I want is for them to take an idea and then infuse it with their own, you know, personal preferences and color choices. So I love that mix of getting ideas from someone, even someone whose like overall work doesn't feel like it's a style you want to delve into, but there'll be some cool technique or product or way of applying paint. And I just find all of that super exciting. I'm really interested in like the process. So making fodder, it's really fun for me.
It's really fun. Yeah, it's funny because I guess there's something about me that really connects with the idea that I could take any art class at any time from any artist, even if I didn't like their work, and I would be able to create something that I liked. Yeah. Because it would just be like a spark, right? Like people spark each other. It sparks in someone, oh, okay, this is how this person is starting out. What if I then do this? So you don't have to do everything in any kind of cookie cutter way. The idea yeah. is you have a spark, and then you can take that spark.
Exactly. Yep, I agree. That's why I call my class Creativity Jumpstart, because I feel like the idea is to sort of jumpstart your creativity with my idea, but you don't try and, you know, slavishly copy it.
Definitely not slavishly copy it. But
not that anyone would want this to. But
this brings up an interesting kind of dilemma that I have with how to keep the Fodder School Facebook groups cohesive and not have them spiral off into everybody just making random mixed media art. Because the thing is, it's like what do you call it when there's two conflicting ideas, but you have to hold them both like as they're both true, but they're both opposite. So, the one idea is I want everyone to be sparked to do whatever they want. Like people can make the fodder and not make the projects. People can do whatever they want. They absolutely like, I encourage that. I want them to do that. But then we have these Facebook groups where people are coming because they want to see what other people are doing with the current project or the other projects that are in that fodder school offering. So when people start going off on tangents, I love that. I want to support. I don't really want that in the Facebook group, because if you've seen a regular mixed media art Facebook group, it's all over.
I have seen that. And then
And it becomes like, I think it just goes to a place where I think we would lose a lot of people's interest, because there is a distraction thing where it's like people could become very overwhelmed. And by keeping the Facebook groups on the tighter side, I have made how it has to be. Keep people's attention on what we are doing, even though at the same time, I'm very happy to see, like, you know, post on Instagram or else, just not in the Facebook group for Fodder School. So it's a conflict, because I don't want people to think that Fodder School is not about doing your own thing, because it is. Go do whatever you want. I'm not the Fodder School police. You can make whatever you want. But the place to talk about what we are making is the private group. If you want to talk about something else, there are so many other groups for that.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. So talk to me about why you decided to say yes when we asked you to join Fodder School 3.
Well, I have such admiration for the approach, and it's also just so well organized and everything so well filmed. I love the variety, and that sort of goes back to the, you know, I love working in a series with one approach and then the next week trying something different. So that constant renewal of inspiration I find wonderful to watch and exciting to participate in. I also really love communicating certain of the techniques that I find myself drawn to repeatedly that I find are really accessible and that people sort of take away a lot of enjoyment from. And I thought that that would be a good venue for sharing that. And I think it'll be really exciting to see also like how people interact with the projects, how other fighter school instructors, you know, their takes on, you know, my project. And it has appealed to me from day one, actually appealed to me before you asked me. Like I already thought it sounded like it would be so cool to do something like that.
So when I first direct messaged you and you saw like me saying, would you be interested in becoming a fodder school 3 teacher? What was your reaction?
I said to my husband, this rock star just asked if I, I would participate.
It's like a mutual admiration society.
He is so not into Instagram. I was like, and he doesn't completely, I mean, he appreciates my world, but doesn't really get everything about it. So I was like, how can I explain like who these people are? They're like rock stars.
To me, you're the rock star. So the people that I ask to be fodder school instructors, to me, those people are rock stars. So it's like, I'm asking people, it's always scary. Every single time I reach out to a new person that I've never had a personal contact with, because a chance for rejection.
I guess so. Although I can only imagine someone saying no because they're too busy or, you know, already have too many irons in
the fire.
Oh, that's
definitely a thing. Similar,
but yeah.
That's definitely a thing. People are very, very in demand, very, very busy.
But fodder school is very prestigious, and it has already, I think, a really such a strong reputation that you would have to really be busy, I think, to not want to participate. Or maybe you'd have, even if you're busy, you'd want to participate. Maybe it just wouldn't work. But I feel like it's sort of like number one in the online mixed media attractions.
Appreciate you saying that because it gives me a little boost of confidence that I need to keep going. Because the recruiting for fodder school teachers is an ongoing process that kind of never shuts off. And we're actually well into recruiting for fodder school 4 at this point.
Wow. Yeah.
And like I said, as much as, you know, I know that fodder school is wonderful, I'm still taking a risk anytime I reach out to someone to say, like, hey, are you interested? Because I'm a person too. And it's like, you know, you're looking, it's like dating, right? You're like asking someone out on a date. You never know if that person is going like to be interested back. It's the funniest thing. All right. Yeah. Did you have something you wanted to say?
No, I was just going to say, I feel like it's just so well organized too. You just do a great job. It's really impressive. And I know it must be so much to pull together, considering how I feel completely swamped by this little one-time exhibit, which is going to end in about, you know, 1 week. It's just sort of, there's a lot of admiration for how many different hats you must wear to pull something like this off. You know, the recruiting, the organizing, and I know you and Tiffany are a team, but it is just a lot for even for a team. And it's just impressive how you pull it all together.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, it's definitely a 7-day-a-week job for both of us.
Yeah.
But I'm at a place where I probably need a 7-day-a-week job in my life because my kids are getting older and they don't really need me. And it's like my husband still works really hard, so I'm alone a lot. And it's like, okay, actually, it's probably good that I have a lot of work to do, because if I didn't, I would probably fall into a depression. So
it's good to be busy. It's and also like happy busy, and also good to be busy with things that you're good at doing. So
yes, it's good to be
found
busy.
Your niche.
Yes, I found my niche, and it is good to be busy. All right, Jennifer Wilkin Pennock, thank you so much for coming on today. This episode is going to be the first in our series about the new instructors that are coming into Fodder School 3, and it's going to be airing as soon as we announce who the Fodder School 3 instructors are in June.
Awesome.
So thank you for coming on. Wildly excited to learn from you. I absolutely am attracted to your artistic voice. And now that I know you a little bit better, I'm just like drawn to you. Like, you are such an interesting human being that's led such an interesting life. And it was just a pleasure getting a bit more about you.
So, well, thank you so much for wanting to get to know me better. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Show Up or Shut Up podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast and leave a rating and review. And once again, you can find me, Wendy, free gifts for newsletter subscribers, online classes with me and many other incredible instructors, my blog, and everything else at willowwanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders. Talk to you soon. Until then, stay curious and keep making.